Thank you all so much for coming. My name is Jeff Higgins. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon at Elaine's, my wife's restaurant. Thank you all for eating and drinking. You're keeping us in business. I believe this is the 131st interview I've done since we've started here. So we've been really fortunate to welcome authors here. We offer free space for authors. We've become a literary hub for the Washington, D.C. area. And we're just, this is honestly one of my favorite things to do, to talk to authors and so many accomplished people like yourself. James Stejka was born in 1954 and grew up in Nebraska. After trying college, he enlisted in the military and successfully passed assessment and selection to qualify for duty with the U.S. Army Special Forces. He served 23 years with Special Forces and Special Mission Units, conducting operations in many interesting places worldwide before retiring as a Chief Warrant Officer 4. He then served as a CIA officer until his second retirement in 2013. Given his background in military intelligence and international political and security affairs, he began to devote more time to historical research and quickly evolved into a military historian. He's the author of articles on military history and conflict archaeology, and he holds a bachelor's degree in history and a master's degree in military studies. He's also worked as a consulting historian for the Nemiv Battlefield Heritage Project in a collaborative effort to record and preserve World War I battle sites in Namibia, and as a conflict archaeologist associated with the Great Arab Revolt Project in Jordan. James is a veteran turned military historian, conflict archaeologist, and author of 12 books, including Special Forces Berlin, Clandestine Cold War Operations of the U.S. Army's Elite, and Masters of Mayhem, a study of Lawrence of Arabia and the inception of modern British unconventional warfare, a Military History Matters Civil Medal winner. He writes a Cold War espionage fiction series entitled The Snake Eater Chronicles that now comprises 5 books, is that right?
Five books.
He currently lives in Alexandria, Virginia with his wife, Wanda. So please welcome James. That's quite a resume you have.
Well, thank God for AI, because right now I can't even fathom how I've written that many books, but especially in keeping my wife around, too, because she's my primary editor, and she has to have a lot of patience.
You know, we owe a lot to our loved ones to make them read all of our work.
Yeah, and she's suffered through it all, so...
So, I mean, let's start, before we get into your books, let's just start with your career a little bit. So, it was at 23 years in Special Forces, and you were all over the world, I assume?
A great deal of my career was in Germany during the Cold War, and it was only about 1989, after the fall of the wall, that I started doing even more travel. With a unit which will remain nameless, but I spent another 7 years with them, and I did a lot of travel in the Middle East and Africa.
And so when you were in Berlin, what was the unit that you were with, or what was the function of the unit, whatever you can tell us about it?
Well, to keep it simple, because there were actually two units, it was the same unit, but it changed its name. It was a Special Forces unit. It was basically a clandestine unit. The East Germans and the Russians were not supposed to know that we were there, and our mission was to prepare for the eventuality of a possible hot war. So our mission, being 90 miles behind the East German border in Berlin, was basically to spread out in the background, in the back areas of the Russian and East German army, and try to slow them down from their onslaught towards the west, if the war would come. So that's what we prepared for. Later on, we got involved with counterterrorism also.
So was that the first time there was a mission like that for Special Forces? Because it's in preparation, so it's mostly intelligence work, correct?
Intelligence work and operations prep, which is a lot of reconnaissance and making sure you know where everything is at. It was actually very similar to what the OSS was doing in World War II. But after World War II... we really didn't have a comparable unit, so this unit existed from 1956 until 1990, and it was a unique unit in the U.S. military. So
you know, you described Berlin at the time as really the front lines and the battle between East and West. So what were the stakes operating in an environment like that?
I was about to say something funny, but I'd probably get thrown in jail. But One of the stakes was not getting arrested by the police, because we tended to do a lot of things that were right on the ragged edge of legality. The stakes when you were in West Berlin were not too onerous, because it was controlled by the Allied authorities, the British, the French, and the United States. Once you got out of Berlin, like into East Germany, a lot of our guys would travel into East Germany as part of what was called the legal espionage mission, or the military liaison mission. Then it became more tenuous. The East Germans and the Russians would actually try to sabotage our mission, and they would chase us down and try to find us. And if they did, they would basically do anything they could to make sure you didn't complete your mission. So it could get dangerous.
Were you there in an official capacity, or was it more like a knock? Were you there under a different role?
It's a very difficult thing to describe, because there was never any official cover plan for our unit. We were there as soldiers carrying American ID cards, but when we went out into the city, we went out as civilians. And we also had identification in time of war that we would carry that was produced by the Central Intelligence Agency that theoretically would have given us enough cover to survive scrutiny by the Russians or the East Germans.
Did that make it somehow more difficult for you, because you're there openly being U.S. military, but then you're having to move into East Germany at the same time?
It made it sometimes difficult to explain, especially to the U.S. military people, because they were, it's sort of like being in an embassy when everybody in the embassy is trying to figure out who the secret agents are. So it was the same thing with the military. They were trying to figure out who you were. And our mission was never explained to anybody except for the commander. And so when you told somebody that our mission was to support the Berlin Brigade in an official briefing, if they didn't know, they would say, okay, you're a logistics person or something along that line. But if they knew the game, then they'd say, oh, you're here to do something unusual, which was true.
So because you're there with an official capacity, then all your adversaries must have had photos and names, and they must have known who you were to be in the country.
Actually, they did not. They knew, they suspected there was a special force. No, they knew there was a special forces unit. They knew approximately where we were located. I went into the East German records after the fall of the wall and asked them to do a thorough search for anything related to the different units, specific names and things like that. And they came back with about 500 pages of documents which they thought were related. And out of that, I only found about three that actually mentioned the unit, but they never mentioned any of the people. So they didn't know who we were exactly.
I mean, but your mission was so critical, right? I mean, for what you were doing, if the war went from a cold war to a hot war, what you guys were doing seems like it's right at the pointy edge of the spear. Would you think that'd be a high intelligence priority for them?
Well, there were two high intelligence priorities for the Russians and the East Germans in West Berlin. One was our unit, the Special Forces Unit. The other was the Army Security Agency, National Security Agency, electronic collection systems. Because Berlin, being so far inside the Warsaw Pact, was the world's most perfect collection point for electronic intelligence. So they were extremely worried about that also. And they spent a lot of effort trying to find out what that was all about.
And what was it like for you as a person? You were there for years, right? What was it like living kind of in that pressure cooker at the height of the Cold War?
It's hard to describe. I've been back to Berlin a number of times, and it's completely different now. The walls are gone. The pressure's off. But at the time, it was, for me, it was almost like living in a Jean Le Carré novel, because you're living in, we had two names for it. It was either the world's largest POW camp or a zoo, because you felt like you were in a cage. And a lot of people did not like it there. They could not adjust to it. But a lot of us, especially the guys that came from the big cities, Philadelphia or wherever, enjoyed it. And a lot of the soldiers, a lot of the special forces soldiers, preferred to be someplace where they could easily go into the woods, go mountain climbing, skiing, things like that, which you could not really do very easily out of Berlin. And they did not adjust well.
So I mean, you were a kid out of Nebraska, right? So how did you fare in a city as crazy as Berlin in that time?
Well, my big town had all of, 500,000 people, and Berlin at the time was about 3.5 million. I think it's almost 10 million now. I was brought up early to actually... I wanted to do this kind of operation. I was brought up on movies and literature about special forces or the OSS in World War II. And then, of course, movies like Where Eagles Dare and Thunderball and Goldfinger, all these kind of action movies were going around in my head. And I was going, as a kid, maybe, I don't know, 10 years old, that's what I wanted to do. And when my dad, who was in the reserves after World War II, brought home a recruiting brochure for special forces, that sort of sealed the deal. And once I found out that there was a special unit in Berlin, I said, that's where I'm going. So I did. I spent 10 years there. So
on the back end of Vietnam, right, it's a very different environment. So was special forces at the time... Right, geared up for like this kind of urban intelligence collection, or was it something you guys had to learn on the fly?
We were basically an OJT unit. There was no other unit in Special Force in the military that did this kind of operation. So when we went there, we were learning it as we went. Now, the unit was established in 1956, so there was a good basis there. And a lot of the people there were people that had fought in the resistance during World War II. We had a lot of Lajak soldiers from the Eastern Europe who wanted to fight communism. And they knew the basics or most of what you need to know to work as an underground unit. Then we had trainers come over from the CIA, and they actually gave us a lot of instruction on the tradecraft required to survive in an underground environment in a clandestine manner. So
I know you have a chapter on tradecraft in your book. It's been a while. What can you tell us about tradecraft at the time?
Well, back then we did not have to worry about smart watches, telephones, and GPSs and things like that. It was basically the same tradecraft that everybody's been using since the 1920s, 1930s. The Russians were really good at it, but basically how to communicate and operate as individuals in a hostile environment, how to communicate through secret messages, through dead drops, through personal meets in the back alleys like they show in the movies, things like that. A lot of it is pretty well known. You have to practice it to do it well. Surveillance, gunner surveillance. You had to be able to do reconnaissance of a target without being seen. And that's, you know, downtown or out in the countryside. So all those things are pretty well known, what you need to do, but you have to practice.
So you were wearing local German clothing to blend in?
I don't know if we blended in or not. Now, some guys blended in better than others. But, yeah, we had a clothing allowance. They give us money, and we go downtown and spend as much as we could to find the best clothes that we could find for that much money.
And how did you, like, did you have protocols? I mean, things that, I mean, you tell you you're being trained by a bunch of different units. Were there things you were just trying to sort of making up as you went?
As a mission presents itself, as you have to figure out how to do any specific kind of operation, you are following what an old grizzled Army colonel once told me, which was the MSU plan, which is to make stuff up. And it's really true because you have to figure out what you want to do, and then you have to figure out the best ways to do it. So we relied a lot on old manuals, old books that told us the direction we needed to go, but then we would have to refine it and do it ourselves until we were competent. That was especially true when we picked up the counterterrorism mission in the 1970s. Berlin was the first U.S. military counterterrorism unit, and we had to use all our resources to figure out how to do that. You have to use guys that know how to shoot. You have to use guys that know how to work in buildings. We had to sometimes use the employees of Pan Am to show us how to get into their airplanes quickly. And so it's all a learning process. You're continually learning, refining, getting new equipment, improving. It's a continuous process.
Does anything stick out in your memory as something creative that you did to overcome a problem and accomplish your mission?
You just put me on the spot. I can think of a few things that we did that told us how not to do things.
And Those are the best stories.
Yeah, well, that's what Edison said when somebody said he had 10,000 failures to make a light bulb. He said, no, I found 10,000 ways not to do it. No, we were doing things like practicing with explosives to get in, to go through doors. You see that quite often in the TV shows now. And one of the probably most dramatic incidents was when we blew a steel reinforced door with just a smidgen too much explosive. And not only the guys on the inside of the room, this was a training exercise, were luckily not hurt, but they were in the far side of the room. But the entire team on the outside was also knocked down. So everybody was in shock. And so we reset and tried it again.
But it opened the door.
It opened the door, yes. Just we couldn't do anything with it at the time.
Getting back to the original mission, who was it, the KGB that was the most formidable foe for you?
They were the most present, the KGB and the GRU, the Russian military intelligence. The third most dangerous was the East Germans. And that was because the East Germans had the most difficulty working in West Berlin because they had to work with, they did not have the documentation to easily come into East Berlin as anything other than East Berliners. Whereas the Russians could come in, or the Soviets could come in, and even if they were caught, because they had Russian diplomatic cards, basically, we could do the same thing in East Berlin. They did not worry about getting arrested because we would just throw them back.
How sophisticated were they? Like when they were doing surveillance, were they obvious?
Blatant, I think is the word, because we ran into the people all the time. Guys would stand outside the military barracks, all the American, the British, the French. The GRU guys would, I think, send their training teams over, and they would stand outside the gate with cameras and take pictures. So
that's a clue.
They were not subtle at all.
So how, when you had to do operations to get into like East Germany, how would you do that? How would you get in? Or can you talk about like some of the, because that seems like it would be pretty difficult.
We anticipated that it would be difficult. After 1961, when the wall was built, that's sort of when everything changed. Each team had its own target, and each team had its own plan for how they would get there, but they did not share them with each other. We compartmented everything. So if one of my team members was, and we were out drinking someplace, well, we didn't talk about operations out there, but I could not ask him what he would do or what their plan was. The only people that knew that was the commander and the operations officer and us. So we would make plans for finding weak spots in the East German defensive system, which was what they called the anti-fascist protection wall that went all the way around the city. The thing about the East German wall was that it was built to protect or to keep their people from coming into West Berlin. it was not built to protect from West Berliners going into West Germany or East Berlin. So you could find weak spots, and that's what we look for.
So what were the defenses like? I mean, they have towers up, they had manpower, barbed wire. Like, what? Tell us a little bit about that wall.
110 kilometers all the way around the city. Their optimum setup was to have basically three walls, a 100-meter open area that they protected. The first wall that we would encounter was the wall that was right inside East Germany or East Berlin. Then there would be what would look like a very well-maintained golf course, a sand trap, where they could see footprints. There would be a secondary fence or obstacles, usually some kind of a vehicle trap. They would have a road that they could drive on, and then there would be a tower about every 100 meters all the way around the city. Beyond that was their second wall or a second fence, which would have trembler devices on it so they could hear anybody that would go through that. And then finally, on the very inside, which was East Berlin or East Germany, would be a third wall. So that depth would vary anywhere from 100 meters down to maybe 20.
So what kind of vulnerabilities did they have in the wall then?
Finding towers that were unmanned, they actually had doorways, which they used for smuggling and other purposes. There were rivers and canals that could be exploited. There's more canalways or waterways in Berlin than there are in Amsterdam.
Wow.
So you could have used those as well to get out.
How about the subways?
Subways were, for the most part, blocked after about 1965. So they would put alarms on them so that if you got too close, it would give them an alert. There were a few that were found that were not alarmed.
So but the trains weren't running back and forth then?
The trains were stopped except for one line, or possibly two, that went underneath. There was one station in East Berlin that you could go into, which was Friedrichstrasse, and there was a train that went under that. And you could go between those two trains. There was an S-Bahn up on the top, an elevated, and then an U-Bahn underneath. You could change inside East Berlin. But all the other stations that had been operational before 1961 were closed down, and they called them ghost stations. And as you went through those stations, you would see East German guards to make sure that nobody got onto the train or got off in those ways. So that made it pretty difficult.
Jim, how helpful were the debriefings of East Germans who had escaped into West Berlin, and debriefings of East German guards who had also defected?
We did not do that personally. There was an Allied effort that was called Joint Refugee Operations Center that did that debriefing. But all the information they got would be collated and then graded for whoever might want to use it, and then it would be disseminated. I must say that if you were in Berlin, you were in the center of probably the best intelligence collection site in the world, because we were getting information that would come down from the electronic surveillance. The aircraft that would fly over were taking pictures. We had the military liaison mission. Like I said, the legal spying in East Germany was collecting information. Our guys would ride with those cars, and they would make diversions to go look at our targets and photograph them. And then, of course, you would get the debriefings of the people that would come across. Guards, not so much, because very few of them actually came across. They were specifically instructed to watch each other. And so there was a shoot. There was basically a shoot order, not only on their own citizens trying to cross, but their fellow soldiers.
You mentioned the smuggling from the guards. To what extent were they vulnerable to, like, bribery or corrupt guards?
Well, they, on their side, they were pretty vulnerable. But we, the West Germans, the West Berliners, and the Allies did not really have too much contact with them. But there was a lot of, there were many criminal elements within West Berlin that had contact with people on the other side. So some people were able to leverage that. And if you could leverage their networks, then obviously you could get things back and forth, or you could get people back and forth.
Did you use criminal groups that were involved with them?
I think only a few instances. Most of what we were doing was looking for people that could help us in the time of war, so we did not have a real good reason to try to exploit them when it was peacetime. So,
to what extent did you develop like human source networks while you were there?
Unless you were a member of the CIA or DIA, one of their human collection teams, you were prohibited from recruiting a source. Now, you could spot, you could look for the right people, you could develop them or assess them and see if they might be good for your use or develop them. But when it came to the point of recruitment, we were forbidden from doing that. So
they're waiting for the hot war to start before you actually recruit the person you've been
recruiting? Like at 12:59, you're supposed to go out and figure out what to do. When 1 o'clock is the time that the war kicks off.
What was the relationship with the Allies that were there? And to what extent were you working against each other or spying on each other?
I don't know how it was in the intelligence unit, but we did not spy on the French or the British. We had mostly some personal relationships. When in the late 70s, when the British Tupara, the 2nd Parachute Regiment, came over, we ended up developing some good relationships with them. Unfortunately, a lot of our best friends were caught up in Northern Ireland. We also had some good relationships with the German police, what they called their Special Operations Command. Not to the point that we were telling them what we were doing. They thought we were doing counterterrorism stuff. But those were the kind of people that we would look for that might be able to give us help in the future. So,
you mentioned the changing mission to terrorism. Which terror groups were there?
The Baader-Meinhof group at the very beginning, what later became the Red Army faction, the Red Cells. To some extent, there was cross-fertilization with the Italian Red Brigades. Carlos the Jackal was operating from time to time there, mostly against the French because he hated the French. Libyans also. Libyans came across to blow up the disco. Several Americans were killed. Iranian groups too. Especially after the Ayatollah took over, Iranian intelligence groups were trying to assassinate a lot of Iranian dissidents were in the country. But our major worry was the RAF and the Red Cells primarily.
So what kind of counterterrorism operations are you conducting?
Well, we were doing a lot of training. We did preparations for TWA, what was that, 747? TWA 747 that was taken in Algeria. We were alerted for that. We actually...
847.
TWA 847. We were actually alerted and moved forward, but the plane flew into Beirut. When that happened, we weren't going there. The Achille Lauro, once it was captured. The biggest operation that we had, though, was the Iran hostage rescue mission. And along with another force, which is commonly known as Delta, our unit was tasked to prepare for that and go in and do the actual rescue of American hostages.
What can you tell us about that mission?
The best part about that, it was a tragic mission because it failed. It failed because of technical difficulties, mechanical difficulties more than anything. The most successful part of that operation was the operational prep that two soldiers from Detachment A, Special Forces in Berlin, did inside Tehran. Because of our training, because we were the only Special Forces unit that was doing clandestine operations like that, two of our people were selected to go in as civilians, under civilian cover, extremely dangerous at the time, to do the reconnaissance and preparation to find the routes in to the embassy and to another target, which was the foreign ministry. And they successfully went in and did all that operation, collected all that information to permit the American forces to plan for the eventual rescue. Unfortunately, everything collapsed when the helicopters failed to deliver, basically.
So how long did it take you to write this route most recently? What is this, like book 7 or 8 or more than that, right? What number of book are we on here?
12.
Impressive. So how long did this take you?
Five nonfiction and 6 nonfiction, 6, I'm working on the 6th fiction. That one took about a year to put together, but really that's my homage to Berlin, because I spent so much time there and it's one of my favorite cities. It's not a city like, it's not a city like Vienna or Paris, or even London. It's got a different feel to it, but because of its role in the Cold War and my own personal involvement with it, I had a lot to bring to that. And the photos and everything that are in there are from when I first got there in 1977 all the way up to last year, 2024. I've pulled in a lot of photos from other people. From the East German spy service. I say it took me a year to put it together, but it was really more than 30 years putting it together. So my novels depends on how good my idea is. Sometimes I can roll with it, get it done in a year, and I'm working on one now that I think is taking, I'm sitting on 2 years right now. The other issue is, because I signed a non-disclosure agreement with the CIA and the Army, everything I write has to be cleared by the government.
How long does that process take?
Well, my Special Forces Berlin book, my nonfiction book, took 16 months. My fiction book out there, The Ratcatcher of Berlin, took 12 days. So you've got a big big variance there.
So you wrote this so quickly, and it's a nonfiction book, so obviously it took a bunch of research. How much research do you do, and where do you do your research? Tell us a little bit about that process, because you're a historian. You know this stuff really well.
Well, the research I did was in Berlin, of course, and I've done some here. I did it in the archives, both downtown at the National Archives, and I've done it in the Stasi archives in Berlin. I refer to a lot of other books that have been written about the city to draw things out. I also do a lot of references to fiction and Berlin, its connection to Berlin. John le Carré's book, Lynn Dayton's books, movies, and things like that. So it's a collection process, a research process, and then a re-research process to make sure the things that I'm writing are actually, one, make sense, and B, are two. Because I have found that you never write a nonfiction based on the information one person gives you. You have to corroborate everything. Yeah.
So how is it going into the Stasi archives? Like that must have been strange after all these years.
It's German efficiency. Because you walk into their headquarters, and they've actually got a couple of different buildings. One is actually in the old American barracks inside West Berlin, where we worked. a portion of the documentation is there. You walk in and it's basically dealing with any other Berliner or any other German. As long as you've got the forms filled out, your I's dotted and T's crossed, and you can convince them that you're there for a good purpose, it's pretty straightforward. It's kind of unsettling walking into Stasi headquarters, for example, and seeing the places where they used to keep people in the dungeons and other things. But other than that, Berlin is so free and open now. So it's a completely different feeling, like I said before.
So when you do all this research, do you use like your fictional writer's kind of instincts for like pacing and putting in what's interesting? I mean, you have to figure out what you're putting in and what you're not, right? How do you do that, and how do you keep the book interesting without putting too much in? What's your decision-making process look like?
Where I might have, when I started out writing history, I think I followed, you know, your basic high school thing where you write down the dates and follow everything chronologically and what happened on this date and things like that. But as my writing has matured and as I've mixed both nonfiction and fiction, I have found that telling the story of what happened and why from a personal view is always the better way to go. And so I try to bring that into my nonfiction as well as my fiction. Rick Atkinson writes like that. He's written some very good nonfiction historical stuff. A couple of British authors, and those have impressed me, and I think it may have subliminally affected how I write.
Do you think it's the way humans are sort of wired to learn through story, or is it the fact that it's just entertaining and so maybe you retain it more because it's fun?
I just like to tell the story so that people will be interested in what happened and how it happened and the feelings of the people behind it rather than just a rote recount of, you know, the events, and try to make that as interesting as possible.
Do you prefer writing the fiction or nonfiction? You're doing both. You're sort of going back and forth.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I haven't decided yet. I'm working on it.
In your fiction, did you have something coming out now, or did the last Snake Eater book already come out?
Yeah, the last one came out in April, and it's called The Ratcatcher of Berlin, and I jumped into my fiction about my unit. When I started writing these, it started about the time I started in the unit, 1977. But the unit had been there already 25 years or so. And so I wrote four novels from 1978 or so on. And then I basically backtracked, and the fifth novel is now what I call the origin story of the unit, and it's based on some stories that I heard but could never really corroborate, but then I got some additional information from people, and by sorting through the Stasi archives, I was basically able to assemble what I call faction, a story based on fact but actually fiction.
Those are the best kind, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So you want to just tell us a little bit about your process when you're writing? You have so many writers in here, and it's a little different for everybody. Are you one of these write-every-day guys? Do you write at a certain time, certain place?
Well, if you're asking me how I write the story, I have no clue, because generally I start out with one idea and then the story develops from there. I have had fictional stories that I knew the beginning, the middle, and the end, and that's basically because I'm tracking historical events, so that's historical fiction. But when I have to make up a story, then it basically builds in my mind. And it might take any one of 16 different paths as I'm writing it. I get up in the morning after my coffee, and I generally spend several hours trying to put things together, and sometimes I'm on a roll and I can put together 1,000 to 2,000 words, and other days I might get 35. So it's an ever-changing process.
Yeah, so I'm interested in you, with your sort of seeing where the story goes. They call them writer's pantsers, right? Writing by the seat of your pants. You're not outlining. Do you have like a vague idea of an ending, or is it just the idea of the story, like a central like concept or the hook? Like, what is it that gets you running on a fictional story?
There again, it depends on how much I've already developed. I'm working on one story now. It's not part of the series. It's more of a espionage novel in Africa. I have developed the first part of it. I've developed the first part of it, but how it's going to end is it's only out there vaguely and sort of like in the mist. I've got some ideas, but it's coming to me very slowly.
Does that get frustrating when you're writing and you're not quite sure where you're headed? Or do you enjoy that process?
It's painful.
I've heard that from a lot of writers.
Sometimes I will be asleep and I'll start thinking about the story, and I will dream where it should go next. And sometimes I wake up and remember that, and sometimes I don't. But I will take those ideas and develop them. And then other times I will just be listening to a podcast or the news, and I will catch a small snippet of something someone has done, something someone has said, and it gives me an idea how to carry it over the next hill.
So do you feel like the story's always kind of in your subconscious? You're always sort of playing with it when you're in that long writing process?
Except when I'm in front of the camera. Yeah, I'm trying not to think of it right now.
Well, if you have a good idea, write it down, because I know how quickly those disappear.
Yeah.
So what's your editing process like?
My wife.
I love it. Fantastic.
I will read through it about 16 times and continually edit and change things. I have this bad tendency of picking out sections of sentences and placing them elsewhere, and generally when I do that, I will either get double words, bad punctuation, things like that. And so she has the right of first refusal and goes through my stuff heavily. It's always a long process, and then generally I give it up to an editor that my publisher works with. So.
Are these under, like the current one, is it under contract, or do you write these on spec and then go to the publisher?
No, I did use a publisher on my own once, but what came back to me did not please me, so I stopped doing that. And now I rely, once we get the final draft, the final manuscript done, it goes to the publisher, and then they contract out with an editor.
Is this Double Dagger? Is that right?
Double Dagger is doing my fiction. They actually did that nonfiction, the first one. Casemate, United Kingdom, is doing my nonfiction.
And what's your experience been like with the publishers? Do they have a lot of editorial changes, or is it more rubber stamped? Like, is it three levels of editing? What's that process like?
My experience with most of them is they will come back with recommendations. They will change things that are obviously wrong, spellings, punctuation, things like that. But if it changes the context or anything like that, or the timing, they will come back to me. And sometimes I will have to rewrite things and go through that again. But it's pretty straightforward. And my work with the publishers has been, I've been extremely lucky. I've Casemate, the commissioning editor there, took on my first project. And basically after that, I might get three words out of my mouth proposing a new story, and she says, I'll take it. And so, you know, I cannot argue with that. You know.
That's great. So when you're doing like a nonfiction like this, are they doing any kind of peer review, or do they do any kind of fact-checking for you?
No. because generally the stuff I write is so far out in left field, there's nobody to fact check.
Yeah, I mean, you're the historian too, right? It would seem like that would be difficult.
Well, the Special Forces Berlin book, I had to go through. I actually briefed it to the commanding general of the Army Special Operations Command, and I had two historians telling me why I couldn't do it. And I had the general going, I like the story, I think you should do it. I was going to do it anyway. Then I had to rely on the pre-publication review board for them to give it a green light. And that was it was interesting because that book specifically opened up the history of that unit. Nothing had been written about it before, and it was classified. And with the publication of that book, it was declassified. But the unit had ceased to exist for over 30 years, so it was time to write the history.
I mean, it's strange that the Army wouldn't be more excited about a book like this, right? Because I heard that unit referred to as like the crown jewel of Special Forces. And it was such a unique unit. Why wouldn't they want to trumpet their successes?
I think there might have been some jealousy involved because these were the two command historians for Army Special Operations Command. They may have wanted to write it themselves, but that's the problem, is those people had no connection to the unit. They had no personal experience with it. Whereas for that book itself, I interviewed and talked to probably 75 people to end up writing it.
And you did that all in basically a year to write this book?
That was the Special Forces Berlin. This one I didn't have to interview so many people. The Special Forces Berlin book took about 4 years to put together.
Yeah, I mean, that seems about right for that level of research, especially with all those interviews. Was there anything in your research process for any of these nonfiction books that really surprised you, that you hadn't been expecting, some kind of gem that you came across?
Well, the gem that I used to write my fiction book was one thing that surprised me, but you have to read it to find out what it is.
teaser.
The other thing was how many people, it was interesting because I went to a lot of people and they said, especially the guys that were in the unit very early on, in the early 60s, they said, I can't talk to you. I signed a non-disclosure agreement, et cetera, et cetera. And so I had several people hang up on me. I had a number of people that wanted to talk to me, luckily. Probably the most funny thing that happened was one guy I had spoken to 6 months previous, and I had closed out the manuscript and everything, and I get a call, and it's the guy that had hung up on me and says, I hear you're writing a book. And I said, yeah, I've got some stories for you. I said, okay, whatever. Yeah.
So, like, because you were in this unit and you had this interest and you knew about it, and the historians who weren't in the unit weren't as interested, if you hadn't written this book, I mean, you know, we all have limited lifespans. When this thing goes, like, these things sort of disappear, right? Is it kind of lost history unless somebody does what you've done here?
Yeah, especially because so much of this history is oral history. There are very few documents left. Unfortunately, when a lot of American units left Berlin and the Special Forces Command down in West Germany moved, a lot of documents were destroyed, erroneously destroyed. And so to put that together would be almost impossible now.
So what do your publishers do to help get this book out there? What do you do? What have you found? I'm always curious with authors. Have you found anything in marketing that works? Because it's so hard, right? There's 3 million books a year that are coming out. How do you break out of all that noise with a really unique book like this? These are really great books.
I find somebody like you.
good luck.
Yeah. And I recommend this entirely. Some companies do better than others. Double Dagger is very short-staffed, and they've got a lot of good books, and they don't have the ability to do a whole lot of marketing. Marketing is expensive. Even Casemate did some of my early fiction, but they drew back because fiction, the business model, doesn't work for them. It's extremely difficult. I mean, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 books a year are being published, either by traditional publishers or by indies. And to market that in this day and age, and you're dealing with, you've got some assistance with social media, but the cost of doing it, the time involved, it's extremely difficult. So the author has to do a lot of work itself. So that's what I do. I spend a lot of time on that.
Is there one thing that you would tell somebody who's thinking about writing a nonfiction book, or is there one thing you've learned through this process that you could give advice to, like, a new writer?
Well, first thing is write something that you are interested in, or write about something that you have an interest in. Try to find as many people as you can that know about that field and interview them, talk to them, and then spend as much time as you can putting it down on paper. You might have to do a lot of research, or you might not, but if you're not interested in the subject, I've had this happen to me a couple of times where people would ask me to write something about a subject I was familiar with, but not really terribly involved with or interested in, I couldn't do it. And so that makes the big difference, is really having interest in it.
So now that you have this book out, is there one thing or one moment in your time in Berlin that sticks out to you, like one kind of hairy moment, or one moment that was a close call, or something that when people talk to you about Berlin, that's the one thing your mind goes to?
I had a very good friend of mine remind me a couple of years of a story. His nickname was Pancho. He said, "You remember that time we came back from West Germany and you were driving that brand new turbo Saab that you bought?" I said, "Not so much." He said, "You remember when I asked you to go off the Autobahn like we weren't supposed to do, to stop at an East German Imbiss to get me some food?" And I said, "Keep talking, John." And it kept going from there. We pulled up in front of this. It wasn't an Imbiss. It was a small restaurant. And I had the oval tax plates on the car, so people thought we were German and not, they didn't know we were Americans. So we got out, and John, naturally, he had a large appetite, got some food, and we're talking to them, and they want to look at the car because they've never seen a Saab Turbo before, and we're talking about the car, and somebody goes, "Your accent's kind of funny. Where are you from?" And we go, "Oh, we're Americans." Suddenly, there was nobody in the restaurant. I said to John, "Yeah, we're running behind anyway, because we had a two-hour limit to get from here to there." And so we hop out, and as we're leaving, a green and white Trabant Volkspolizei tucks in behind us and turns on its lights. So we did about a 30-minute escape and evasion drive to get back onto the Autobahn and show up at Checkpoint Bravo about 40 minutes late. And then we had to explain to the MPs why we were late. We made up that story. But anyway, I did not get thrown out of the unit, and neither did my buddy, but we had a good time.
I love it. Maybe not telling people you're Americans would be part of your protocols going forward.
A small lesson learned. Yeah, whatever.
Like you said, it's another thing you shouldn't do.
We were trying to pay in dollars, so that had this.
All right, I'm going to come around with the microphone for both of the podcast and for this one. So if you have any questions, please just raise your hand. Get one in the back.
Yeah, thank you. So question, knowing that being over in Germany, all Americans aren't getting all the information of what's going on and what the stories are, what would have been one thing or a couple of things that you wished when you were over there that you wish Americans would have known?
There's somebody in this room that could probably speak to this better than I can, but had we known more definitively about the strength and capabilities of the Russian and the Warsaw Pact armies, we might not have had to spend so many years in that position. But you can't change history. We were extremely lucky just in how we managed to survive without going to war. There were a couple of instances where we came very close. 1983, the so-called Able Archer exercise. And had we known about that, and I did not know about it until later on, we might have prevented, well, it ended up being okay, but it came very close to possible war. So things like that are things you think about now, but you can't go back and change. There are instances I remember where we came very close to war, not just us, but the entire European consortium. One of the ones I mentioned, remember very clearly is when Poland was starting to break up, go to its new government, and our electronic intercept system had very good, like I said, excellent capabilities. They brought down, they disseminated a message, a telephone conversation they had received, where the Russian prime minister, not the prime minister, the
general secretary,
the party chairman, or communist party chairman, called the president or the chairman of the Polish government, and he said, basically, if things get bad there, do you want Russian troops to come in and help you stabilize the situation? And the Poles said, yeah, we'll do that. And then the Russian goes, okay, if we do that, then at the same time, we're going to move the East Germans into Poland from the West. And the Polish leader said, hold on. If you guys come, it's okay. If the Germans come in across our frontier, it'll be war. And we were in Berlin at this time, about 70 miles from the Polish border, going, this might get a little difficult. Luckily, they talked it out. But, things like that always, are in the back of your mind.
So when you're stationed in West Berlin and you're about to go to East Berlin on an operation for 2-3 days, do you have family with you in West Berlin, and what do you tell them about where you're going, why you're going to be gone, and when you think you'll be back?
We weren't really doing secret missions into East Berlin like that, but a lot of people did have family there. And for example, when you went into East Germany with a military liaison mission, you basically said, this is what we're doing. You don't tell them about where we're going or what we're doing, and we should be back on a certain day. I mean, you can't say much more than that. I mean, somebody I know has a lot of interesting experience with that, where I would say one thing, and then 3 days later, she was wondering why I wasn't coming back. So it's always difficult being a family member when you're married to a serviceman or anybody involved in this kind of stuff in the government. My fondest memory of scaring my wife was when I called her on New Year's Eve, 1993, using a satellite phone. And I'm standing next to a British general by the name of Rose in Sarajevo. And she had no idea where I was. And she goes, where are you? And I said, we're at church. It's the New Year's celebration. I said, what's it? Where are you at? I said, Sarajevo. Silence. So somebody wasn't pleased. But anyway, these things happen. I have learned that you keep them informed.
Thank you, Jeff, for hosting this discussion here. But, Jim, I wanted to ask you if you have a single most harrowing experience that you had, whether with like an East German officer or a Soviet officer, or the single most like scary moment you may have had on the Eastern side.
I've had interesting things happen like that in other locations, but I never really had anything that scared me as much as going in front of the colonel of my unit and and having him stare at me for about a minute before he told me to get out of his office. That's all he said. I've had people pull guns on me in other countries, and I'd have to explain to them, you know, that I am not a bad guy. But not so much in East Berlin or West Berlin, for that matter. So.
Real power, right?
Yeah, real power. Lucky, actually.
Jim, thank you for coming and doing this talk. We really enjoyed it. When you were talking about driving on the Autobahn, were you going from West Germany to East Germany? Is that
Checkpoint Alpha at Helmstedt to Checkpoint Bravo at Dreilinden, okay. Which was the 90 miles between West Germany and West Berlin. You had to check out with the MPs at Helmstedt,
right?
The British, French, and the Americans. You had to go through the Russian checkpoint,
right?
And then you go through the Russian checkpoint at West Berlin, clear them, go in to see the American checkpoint before you got into the city. And it was always, you had a limited amount of time to do it.
So I saw a video about this, which it was an instructional video for British officers, and it was saying that if you get pulled over or something happens, do not surrender to the East German authorities, only to the Soviet officer specifically. Is that accurate? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Because we were an occupation army in Berlin, the East Germans had no jurisdiction over us. So they could not touch us. The Russians could delay us to give us a problem, but they couldn't do anything. When you were driving in your official capacity with your car or military, we carried what was known as flag orders. It had a big American flag on it, and it was written in French, English, and Russian, not in German. And you would present them to the MPs to say you're cleared to travel, and they'd just stamp them. The Russians would look at them, and they had no clue what they said because most of them were uneducated Cossacks from somewhere. And they would take a picture of it inside this small office and give it back, stamp it. And then you go on to the next Russian checkpoint, the same thing. They didn't know the times or anything. They didn't care. And then you go to the final MP place where they'd say, okay, you made it on time or you didn't make it on time. And so, by the way, our excuse was a flat tire, that why we were so late. And while I was inside explaining this to the MPs, the guy said, yeah, sure, right. And he goes, let's go check your car. And in the meantime, my buddy John had done something. We open up the trunk. He's John sitting in the front of the car. The MP bounces a baton against the tire, and it's flat. So John, you wonderful guy, he had emptied the air out of the tire, anticipating what I was going to say. Anyway, that was probably one of the scarier moments.
Good tradecraft.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Have you ever driven a Trabant?
A Trabant?
No.
Why would I want to? My friend up here up front and I both have a similar story. As I saw a Trabant after the opening of the wall on Autobahn number 9, just north of Nuremberg, what was left of it, I saw a tire sitting in the middle of the Autobahn. And about 50 feet on was a big, huge 450 Mercedes that had barely a scratch on it. The Trabant had been vaporized when the Mercedes ran over it. So this is not a good car to drive on the Autobahn.
Hey, thank you. Hey, Jim, real quick. There was a constant problem and a constant issue with cover for the unit. In many cases, individuals lived in military housing. Et cetera. Now, during your research years later, do you think the fact that the unit also had the dual mission, the CT mission, the fact that that was a little bit more overt, you saw, you know, people spending a lot more time in the range, do you think that helped to provide some cover for the, you know, stay behind, you know, mission and training for that?
It made more sense when people saw it that that's what we were doing. It did not really combine so well with our undercover mission. But I think the biggest problem with the unit was when you put a 100-man unit overseas in a place like Berlin without a cover plan of any sort. This was 1956, and nothing was ever done. Yeah, we had a cover plan for the wartime mission. You know, they gave us good ID cards, so we were, our Western ID was going to go out the window. But it did make a difference. And then when there was a switch between the two units for cover reasons, the new unit had the mission. It was completely different, different location. It was set up as, quote-unquote, a security evaluation unit. So for us to be in uniform at the range, firing weapons and doing things like that made sense. And the CT mission just fell right in with that. So one mission was Sub Rosa, and the other one was visible. So.
All right. Well, so I have a couple of requests for everybody. If you would, just jump on Amazon and leave them a 5-star review. It really makes a big difference just for visibility so people can see the books. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's Literary Salon, I'd also appreciate it if you could rate us on Google or Yelp or wherever it is you rate restaurants. We also have Barnes & Noble in the other room. This is a really unique piece of history here, and it's a one-of-a-kind book. So this is your chance not just to get it, but you're signing, right, Jim?
Yes.
He'll be signing up here, too. So please please thank Barnes & Noble for coming out if you can and buy a book or two. He's got some of his other – I think they have 4 of your titles there right now, a couple of the fiction books as well. So I'm definitely going to pick one up when we're done here.
Great.
Jim, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeffrey.